That's the sound of the European starling. Why are they singing, and what emotions, if any, are they expressing? I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. We know birds sing to attract a mate in the spring, but why do they also sing in the fall and winter? Why do they form flocks? What can we learn about humans, our addiction to opioids, social behavior, and mental health from studying birds? Joining me for Why Do Birds Flock, Sing, and Play is Lauren Readers, professor and chair of the Integrative Biology Department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
I'm always interested in what brings people to the career they have. What led you to studying birds, particularly this aspect of birds?
Well, I think I was always interested in animal behavior ever since I was a small child. And when I went to graduate school, I started to study homing pigeon navigation because I was fascinated by the fact that you could take a bird to a place where it's never been before and it could get home, because I thought I could not do that. I mean, Now, of course, we could with a GPS or with our cell phones. But I thought, how do they do that? How can a bird, when, you know, we think of bird brains, you think perhaps they're not very clever. I thought, it's amazing that they can do something we can't. And so while I was studying homing pigeons, so they're not songbirds, they don't learn songs, practice songs like songbirds do. They vocalize. But songbirds, because I was studying birds, I think I started to read more about them, and I became really fascinated at the complex vocalizations that birds learn and produce in distinct contexts, and I sort of became riveted. I wanted to understand what are they communicating when they sing. And also, again, you know, people think of birds maybe as having bird brains, but the fact that they could learn these extremely complicated vocalizations, that, I think, is really what got me hooked. And so since then, I've just continued in that area.
Well, let's talk about that term bird-brained, because we use that to mean somebody who is not smart, somebody who's kind of shallow and scattered and, you know, just not an intelligent person if you're bird-brained. Why did we adopt that label then?
Yeah, I hope we can change that stereotype of birds being, you know, bird-brained being something negative. But I think that early on, people sort of thought that flight was incompatible with brains. And so there was a trade-off that birds had to become, you know, really aerodynamic. And so everything kind of shrunk.
So you mean the size of the brain is relative to the rest of their body?
I would say bird brains, actually, this has all been dismantled. Birds do have proportionately, you know, very large brains for their body size. But I think the idea was something that there was a trade-off. They devoted the brain space they did have to flight. And this is in part because if you look at a mammalian brain or a human brain, it's very wrinkly and convoluted. And if you look at the brain of a bird, it's actually very, very smooth on the outside. And ages ago, researchers looked at the bird brain and they looked at human brains. And you can see human brains have cells that are organized in a very specific fashion. And in birds, you just don't see that. And more recently, people have found that the bird brain and even the human brain, the mammalian brain, are not that different. They have similar brain areas. They have similar patterns of connectivity. They even have similar neurochemicals. But it's the way that they're organized that seems to be what's different. And I think if you look at birds, I mean, the fact that homing pigeons can return home, and it's not something we could do without a GPS, the fact that songbirds can learn these elaborate songs, species-typical songs, and, you know, there are many examples of birds doing amazing things, like hiding seeds that they can find months later.
I see that your lab sometimes studies flocks and the flocking behavior. Can you talk about that? And, oh, maybe before that, we should talk about why so much of your work has focused on the starling.
Oh, yes. That's a question people ask, because if you love birds, if you're an ornithologist, you may hate starlings because they are considered a tremendous agricultural pest. They are an invasive species, so they're not originally found in the United States, and they will kind of kick out native breeding birds. But what I think is really fascinating about them is two things. One is the flocking that you just mentioned, and then also the singing. So starlings are songbirds, and songbirds are unique in that they are vocal learners. And I should say that vocal learning is very rare across the animal kingdom. Humans, we learn our vocalizations, you know, basically from our parents. And there are very few other animals that do that. Seals will learn their vocalizations, bats actually, dolphins. There's evidence that elephants learn their vocalizations, but most non-human primates don't learn their vocalizations. But songbirds do. and songbirds. So starlings are songbirds, and I should say chickens are not songbirds. Hawks are not songbirds. They do not learn their vocalizations from adult tutors. But songbirds do. And starlings, I think, are really impressive in this regard. They can produce songs that can last 72 seconds long, and they're vocal mimics. So they always start off their song with a few intro whistles, and then they start incorporating vocal mimics. We hear them whistling songs that are whistled by our animal caretaker. They'll whistle sirens that we hear on campus. They even mimic human speech. And then they start rattling. It almost sounds like they're knocking on wood. And then they scream at the end of it. And so this is kind of something that I think if you're just passing a tree full of starlings, you can't hear these distinct features of song. But now, hopefully, that I've mentioned this, you may listen and hear mm-hmm. these remarkable songs. And starlings continue to learn song throughout their lives. Some songbirds learn one song when they're young, and they produce that song for the rest of their lives. But starlings continue to incorporate new elements into their songs, which I think is fascinating.
You were starting to talk about flocking. So the starlings sing, and it sounds like they're mimics the way a parrot might be a little bit, picking up on, which I didn't know about starlings. I mean, we think of the minor bird or parrots or others that can mimic human speech, but never thought about starlings picking up what they hear.
Little known fact. That's right.
Is there any evolutionary value or advantage that came from having that ability with the vocalization and the mimicry?
Yeah, you know, I think people do ask that question. You know, what is the evolutionary value of the vocal mimicry? And, you know, I'm not an expert in that area, but people look a lot at bird song and what it's communicating to females, because one of the best studied roles for bird song is males use song to attract females. And so people have long asked, well, what does a female get by picking a male that sings, you know, a certain type of song? So females are choosy and they tend to prefer to mate with males. This is across many species. They prefer to mate with males that sing long, complex, elaborate songs that males sing in the same way again and again. So it's a very stereotyped song. And so people say, what do females get when a male can do this? And one thing is that some idea is that it tells you something about the condition the male was experiencing when he was young. So if he was in good physical condition, he wasn't infested with parasites, he had a lot of food, he could probably spend a lot of time listening and practicing song. And so some birds learn song only once when they're young. So when they're older, if they're singing a really nice species-typical song, that would suggest that when they're young, they were probably in pretty good condition. Maybe they'll make good fathers. Because most songbirds, males and females, are raising the offspring. You want a good father. And then they find that when males produce song, it reflects something about their current condition. So if they can produce the song and do it in a very stereotyped fashion, and they can produce it at very high rates, that's telling the female that he's currently in good condition. And if he can produce a really elaborate song, it's telling her something about the quality of the male. And I don't mean she's consciously evaluating the quality of the male, but when a female mates with a male whose songs convey these characteristics, it's a good deal, right? It's good for her offspring.
And what about the female songs then? You know, the female starling, what does her song look like then compared to the male song?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that because, you know, for many years people focused on male song because it's something that's very obvious. In the spring, you know, this is when you think of birds are filling the skies with their songs, and a lot of that is males trying to attract females. So that's received a lot of attention. But females often do sing in many species. Female cardinals sing, female robins sing, and female starlings do sing at high rates. But we're saying that the function of the song seems to be different. So male is in spring during the breeding season. So starlings restrict their breeding to spring, which makes sense because you don't want to lay your eggs now, for example, dead of winter, wouldn't survive. So they restrict their breeding to spring. And when males are singing in spring, they're attempting to attract females. But if you present females with other females, they also sing in spring. And it's not to attract the female, but it seems that it's designed to repel the female. So two of the primary functions of the song are mate attraction, but also territorial defense, and it seems that females are trying to defend the mate. They don't want him to mate with other females. But we'll get to this, I know. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about the fact that they don't only sing during the spring breeding season.
There's got to be some other reason.
Yeah.
Before we get to that and why they sing in the fall and winter, what the kind of intrinsic rewards might be for that, what about flocking? What can you tell me about what starlings do and why?
Yeah. So we for a long time also focused on males singing courtship song, and we started to study females singing and also in the breeding context. But one thing I thought that was really interesting is during the spring, males and females, they're pairs. They pair up. So a male will sing and attract a female to a nest site. They nest in holes, so he'll attract her to his hole. Outside the breeding season, so fall and winter months, you will see that starlings become incredibly socially tolerant. So in spring, maybe they'll be a little bit defensive, a little bit more aggressive. They're not incredibly aggressive birds. But in fall and winter months, they become very socially tolerant, and they seem to be attracted to each other. And this evidence raises that they form enormous flocks, and they will spend fall and winter in these flocks, and it's thought that the importance of the flock is that it serves as protection. There's safety in numbers from predators when the birds are vulnerable during the winter months, and it's also been found in flocks that birds seem to forage more efficiently. They're better able to acquire food. So there's some important functions for this flocking behavior, and I just was really interested in why is it that at one time of the year they are not as gregarious, so not as social, and at another time of the year, it completely switches and they become incredibly gregarious, forming these large flocks.
And so what did you discover?
Well, what we became interested in, okay, we kind of came at this from the angle of singing, and we were first saying, well, in these flocks, they sing. They sing and they sing and they sing. But it was very different from what we were seeing in spring. So in spring, males, we were concentrating on males at this time, they were singing to attract females, and they sing that rigid, stereotyped song. And in fall, both males and females were singing. They were singing a lot. And one thing that was different is they didn't seem to look at each other when they were singing. They almost seemed to be ignoring one another. And if you look at the literature, it seems like song in these flocks is really important. It keeps flocks together. So it plays this role in social cohesion. But the structure of song is different. It's a little bit sloppier. And it's not something that's very easy to hear. You know, I think it must be easy to hear for the starlings. But it becomes sloppy. So we looked at male song in spring when they're courting females. We looked at male song in fall when they aren't. And in fall, they kind of, I mentioned their four elements of song. They would put things all out of order. They'd stop right in the middle of a song. They would not produce the elements as stereotyped a fashion. And so a student in the lab at the time, he said, it's like they're producing freeform jazz.
You know? I was just thinking it's like more like improv.
Yeah, he said they're riffing. They're just riffing. And we do know that because starlings are learning songs throughout their lives, one possibility is that this is an important time for them to practice songs that they then will use in these more serious contexts to attract a mate or maybe defend a territory.
How do you study birds, what they're doing in a flock formation? Because it seems that it would be, you know, easy to study a bird if it's kind of still or in a contained space. But if you've got a huge flock, and I don't know how many birds we're talking about that form a flock, how do you even hear that they're singing? Or when you talked about how they don't look at each other, it just seems like you'd have to have really powerful lenses to be able to study that and see that.
What we've been doing is taking birds and putting them in outdoor aviaries. And so that does allow us to focus a bit more. So you can go out in the field and you can use these amazing shotgun microphones and really focus in on birds. But what we've been able to do is you take the birds into the lab, and they are quite comfortable singing in front of us, especially in spring. In spring, you just set up some nest boxes in an outdoor aviary, and the birds, the males, will take over those nest boxes and start singing immediately. And so then we can really record songs. We can put a microphone. Males prefer to sing from a certain perch or from a nest box. You stick a microphone right in the nest box. And in fall, it is a little more difficult. So we still have the birds in these outdoor aviaries full of plants and branches and waterfalls, basically everything that the birds like. And when they're in the fall flocks, they're a little more skittish, and I think that's adaptive because they're vulnerable to predation. And in spring, they're so focused on mating, they kind of ignore you a little bit. But if we spend a little time with them, they become very comfortable with us, and they'll just sing right in front of us, like sit a foot away from my face and sing. It's a little bit harder to record the song, but we'll put microphones where the birds tend to prefer to perch. And then we can record the song, and then we can come in and we can do elaborate acoustic analysis and just compare kind of the structure of the two songs.
So when you're talking about flocking, you're not necessarily talking about it in flight, but just a group together.
That's a good question. So the starlings are definitely famous for these murmurations. And so you could go on YouTube. Actually, if you go on YouTube, you can hear them sing. You can hear them mimic human speech, which I think is really interesting. It almost sounds unbelievable. And you can also see them forming large flocks. I know there's some famous videos from Ireland, famous videos from Rome. They even have somebody with a camera that they are on a drone that is following the birds around. It's really amazing. So in these flocks, yeah, they're mesmerizing. They're like all over the sky forming different shapes and patterns. And they tend to form these murmurations as they're collecting to kind of form roosts where they're protected overnight. I think safety in numbers again. But yeah, they do form these amazing flocks. And we study them sort of during the day when they're, you know, not when they're forming those amazing murmurations, but when they are flocking. They'll spend a lot of time during the day in flocks. They're a little bit smaller, though. And our flocks tend to be maybe 10 birds, 12 birds. They can be larger in nature.
One thing I've always wondered, too, about, well, let's say you see a formation of birds flying in a V shape.
Yeah.
I always wonder, like, okay, so who decided they were the leader of that and that it was time to go? And sort of the leadership, if you have a group, it becomes interesting, you know, how did the decision to flock at that time and in that way
happen? That's a great question. So, I know, you know, in the V shape formation, you imagine this is aerodynamic and they're kind of drafting off one another. And when you look at the starlings in these flocks, one question people ask is, why aren't they running into each other, smashing into each other and falling to the ground? And I've heard that can happen. They can make mistakes. But people are really interested in this kind of collective group movement behavior. And I haven't studied this myself, but what I've read is it seems like they are paying attention to maybe five birds around them, five or six birds. They're not looking at the flock as a whole. And if those birds start to move, they have, you know, really quick reflexes and they very quickly will turn in the same direction. And so for the most part, they avoid running into each other, which is pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. So it seems like there's no one leader. It seems like it's kind of, I guess, a groupthink kind of a thing.
And with singing, is there a superstar? In other words, you know, do you have individual differences? I mean, you talked about how some birds had, depending on how they were raised, might have a different kind of quality to their singing. But do you find that there might be a sort of superstar starling that has an amazing musical repertoire?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I would say yes. We definitely see a lot of individual variability. And in spring, what we see is that some males will successfully take over these nest holes and they will sing elaborately to the females. Males that don't take over the nest holes, they don't sing. And sometimes if you remove one of the males who did take a nest site, like you could remove him just to trim his toenails, and the other male may take over and then he'll start singing. So first of all, I think that's fascinating that they will inhibit song production until they have the resources that they need to breed. But in fall and winter, they sing. I would say everyone in an aviary will sing. So if we have 12 birds in an aviary, all 12 are singing. But some will sing at really high rates, and they do seem to get the group going. There is, in spring, you can get a male to sing by presenting him with a female. You can get a female to spring by presenting her with a female, you know, rival. But in fall, nothing really gets them to sing. They sort of have to erupt into spontaneous song. But almost always, it's one or two birds in the flock that start singing, and then they get the whole gang going. And we find, and others have reported, that those birds that sing a lot in fall are also the ones that sing a whole lot in spring. And so there is variability in terms of, like, how elaborate the songs are. Part of that could be age, because if the starlings are continuing to learn songs, the older birds are definitely going to have the more elaborate repertoires.
I know some of the papers that your lab has come out with talk about opioids and about pleasure and reward. We're going to talk about that and more when we continue with University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Lauren Readers, and we are talking about why do birds flock, sing, and play. We've been talking about your work on starlings and the different kinds of singing and flocking behavior. And I know that almost every paper that I looked at from your lab ends with some possible suggested parallels between bird behavior and human behavior. Is it far off to think that what we find in a flock of starlings might have meaning or relevance for ourselves?
Yeah, it's a good question, because you could say, are we just studying a bird thing? Or could this apply to other animals and, you know, perhaps even humans? And You know, we talked a little bit earlier about the bird brain and how people at first thought it was so different from the mammalian brain. They thought it was really primitive. And in fact, I didn't mention, but they would name brain areas things like paleostratum primitivum, like the word primitive is right in there. Mm-hmm. And they have really refined the bird nomenclature to reflect the fact that it's recognized now that the bird brain is a lot more like the mammal brain, including the human brain, than we previously thought. So brain areas involved in vocal learning, only animals that can learn vocal behaviors have a very specialized group of brain regions that is devoted to vocal learning. And birds actually have something kind of similar to what you see in humans that relates to language production in humans. Something similar is found in birds. And when it comes to social behavior, the brain regions involved in social behavior, they seem to be very similar. And the idea is that they're evolutionarily conserved. And so birds and mammals diverged from a common ancestor millions of years ago. But it's thought that perhaps that common ancestor had brain regions involved in social behavior that, as evolution occurred, were maintained. And so that perhaps, you know, what we look at in birds does relate to what might occur in humans.
And I think with humans, it's been shown that like singing in a choir
mm-hmm.
can bring all kinds of pleasure. More, first of all, that singing can, and then singing in a group brings even more in terms of, I don't know whether it's the endorphins or the whatever it
yeah.
is, but some kind of pleasure is increased with that behavior. Can you talk about that, about the sort of study of pleasure in birds and what we learn about our own needs and social behavior?
Yeah, that is something that we are really interested in. And so our focus sort of on pleasure and emotional states in birds, it began when we were studying actually the sexually motivated male song, males attempting to attract females. And we knew that they were highly sexually motivated. And we thought, well, why do they do that? You know, is there some reward? And I think the reward there is obvious. They sing, they attract a female, they mate, and they actually will stop singing, at least temporarily. So it seems like the focus of that song is really mate attraction. And the reward is attracting a mate. But outside the breeding season, the males and females would sing. And they wouldn't look at each other. They'd just be singing. We knew it was important for vocal learning. We knew it was important. You know, it's not to say it's not an important behavior. It's probably important to keep the flock together. But in an immediate sense, we just didn't know why they were singing. They didn't attract a mate. They don't repel an intruder. They just sing and they ignore each other. If you throw a female into a flock of males in fall, they ignore her. And we started to wonder, well, why would birds do this? Why do animals do anything for no apparent reason? And when we looked into literature, the best example we could find is social play behavior, playful behaviors. Why do animals play? Obviously, it's important. It's developmentally important. And I'm thinking of puppies, rough and tumble mm-hmm. play, or children, you know, rolling around mm-hmm. on the ground. And that's important. It's physically, you know, physical development, mental development. You learn kind of social give and take. And so it's not to say it doesn't have a function. But in an immediate sense, why do we play? And I think the answer is because it feels good. It's fun, right? Play is nearly synonymous with the word fun. And in fact, Darwin proposed that during the breeding season, males are singing for love. But outside the breeding season, he actually suggested maybe birds were singing for their own amusement. And so I think that we became really interested in the possibility that birds are singing outside the breeding season because it's self-reinforcing, because maybe it induces a positive emotional state. And so we started to study this. We started to wonder, you know, how can you ask a bird if it feels good? And so that's been a challenge. But what we did is we looked at literature from psychology. And there are many reasons that you might ask an animal how it's feeling. And a common reason is because in studies of drug use, to try to understand drug abuse and ways to prevent drug abuse, there are these studies in rats that use something that's called a conditioned place preference. And the idea is that you could take a rat, and I'll use an opioid example. We've mentioned opioids a mm-hmm. couple times already. Mm-hmm. So heroin's an opioid. Fentanyl is an opioid. And what they would do is give a rat fentanyl and put it maybe in a polka dot chamber, and then later give it a control solution in a striped chamber. And later, with no fentanyl and no control solution, you just put the rat and you say, do you prefer to spend time with polka dots or with stripes? And if a rat received fentanyl or heroin or morphine in a chamber that had polka dots in it, they later will spend almost all their time in that polka mm-hmm. dots. And the idea is that, well, taking heroin or fentanyl for a rat is rewarding. And so we looked at that literature and we tried to adapt it for singing. And what we did is we had birds singing in spring. We had males singing to attract females, or we would have males singing in these large flocks for no apparent reason. And we thought in those flocks that they are singing, perhaps because it's rewarding, or maybe a positive state facilitates song, but somehow it would be associated with a positive state. And what we found is you'd have the male sing. So let's say we had males singing in a flock, put them in a polka dot chamber. And then later we said, do you want to hang out with polka dots or do you want to hang out with stripes? And males that sang at high rates in those flocks in fall and winter months would develop a strong preference for the polka dot side. And actually we used color, so it'd be a blue side or a red side. But they've developed a strong preference for a place that was associated with the singing in flocks. And they did not do the same for spring song. And so we do think that, you know, spring song is rewarded by mating, and that fall song, this suggests that either a positive state is facilitating the song, or maybe the act of singing itself is rewarding.
So when you talk in your papers about the opioids, I guess I only have heard that used in terms of the actual drugs, but opioids are also some sort of a self-produced, kind of like a hormone or something that's there in the brain?
That's right. So we are very familiar with fentanyl and heroin because of the opioid epidemic. And obviously, people are taking that for a few reasons. And one reason, of course, it induces pleasure. And then, of course, there's the whole addiction problem. But humans and also birds, you produce your own endogenous opioids. And so we think that it's the endogenous opioid release that is facilitating the bird song and also may be released as a result of the singing behavior.
And what's the relationship then between that, the opioids, and something like endorphins or I don't know what the other ones are.
Yeah.
But I know, for example, you can feel better if you exercise, let's say,
or
if you sing, or, you know, there's these things where it can induce endorphins or something.
That's right.
Is that similar then to the opioids?
Yeah, that's a lot of what we're looking at. So endorphins are a type of opioid.
Okay,
so
I didn't know that.
Like the perfect example. And so there are a few opioids that are produced, but we do think it would be endogenous opioids that might be released. And I think, so one thing that I thought was really interesting is, you know, the birds are singing, and we don't think it's like humans singing, but it is a form of vocal production. And we looked at literature on vocal production and opioid release in humans, or at least indirect measures of opioid release in humans. And a couple things that we found, laughter, there's some evidence that it might release opioids, and there's evidence that swearing might release opioids. And so a little detail of that study, and I'm really just giving a very brief overview, but the general idea was that opioids, they induce pleasure, but they also induce analgesia. So if you go to the hospital and you're in pain, you're going to receive an opioid, and it's going to reduce your pain. And so what we saw in the literature is there's an example of a study in humans where they had humans stick a hand in ice water, and they had them swear. And humans who were swearing could keep their hand in ice water longer than humans who were just saying other words that weren't curse words. And it turns out that tolerating this cold is opioid dependent. And so the idea is that swearing is releasing opioids and it's allowing you to keep your hand in the cold water longer because it's inducing analgesia. But we saw that literature and we thought, well, that's interesting. I wonder if singing might lead to opioid release in birds, and could we test it, you know, this indirect way? And so it turns out that opioids, if you have high levels of opioids, you can tolerate cold for longer. You can also tolerate heat for longer. So we kind of switched our design up, but we had birds singing. So these were males, again, singing to attract females. And we compared them to males singing in these large flocks. And then we would immediately grab the bird after it was singing, and we would dip its foot in warm water. And so this water, it was like a coffee. We had a barista who worked in the lab, and she said it was like a cafe Americana. So it's hot, but it's not too hot. We'd stick our fingers in. You'd say, ooh, that's a little hot. You know, like sometimes you get into a hot tub and it's a little hot for you. So it was hot. It was mildly unpleasant. But we would take the birds and we would, after they were singing, dip their foot in the hot water. And what we found is that birds in flocks that sang at high rates, they just keep their foot in the hot water. They just keep it there. And this suggests that opioids are being released and inducing this analgesia. And birds that didn't sing as much, they took their foot out much more quickly. And what was interesting, it was only observed in these flocks. And so the birds that were singing to attract mates, no relationship between singing and keeping your foot in this hot water. It just didn't matter. So it seems very specifically that like one-to-one link to opioid release seems to really have to do with the flock song. And so again, we think what may happen is perhaps joining the flock is leading to this endogenous opioid release, like endogenous endorphins. And then singing in the flock, the act of singing itself may release opioids. A little bit like, you know, we talk about exercise can lead to this good euphoric feeling. I think actually with exercise now, they're thinking endocannabinoids may be what underlies that. So for a long time, they focused on opioids, endogenous opioids like endorphins. And now there's some evidence that it might be endogenous cannabinoids, which are you produce your own natural cannabinoids and they bind to receptors. And it's the same receptors that marijuana, the active component in marijuana. So it seems like, yeah, when birds sing, there is actually a little bit of evidence that cannabinoids might be involved in this flock song as well.
So I'm trying to think what the, I guess, what the outcome or what the meaning of it is. So let's say you learn that birds that sing in a flock, so you have a sort of double whammy. You've got the socialization that comes from being in a flock as opposed to being alone. And they're singing. So the singing itself brings pleasure. So you've got the double effect. What does that then carry over to humans if we're trying to figure out about what do we do with a country that has an opioid, you know, epidemic?
Oh, yeah.
What do we do if we're trying to learn about how to help those who are battling addiction? How do we help those who are feeling depressed or isolated? You know, when you look at what you see in birds, what comes into your mind is sort of interesting in terms of if you were going to talk to a psychologist working on studying humans.
Yeah, that's right. And that is tricky because I know people are spending years of their life figuring this out, and I can't say, oh, well, you know, the birds say we do this, and I'm going to solve this problem. But we do know that there are many things that can release endogenous opioids and even release these endogenous cannabinoids that I just mentioned.
And endogenous, by that you mean produced from within?
Naturally released, and so, you know, it is during the pandemic, I think, well, okay, so we talked about the you're in the flock and you're singing and you're socializing and so there's reward. And I think that may actually be part of what reinforces this flocking behavior. A while ago, you said, why do they flock? I think one reason might be because when they're singing in these flocks, it releases the opioids and they get this like condition place preference, this preference for the flock. So I think part of why the birds are socializing is because it releases the opioids and that's rewarding. I think also part of the reason that the birds are socializing is because it reduces a negative state of being alone. When our starlings, if we are to catch one, so sometimes their toenails will grow long and we'll just trim a toenail. So if you catch a bird, take it out of the flock. When you release the bird, it goes back to that flock so quickly. It almost looks panicked to rejoin that flock. And so I think being away from a flock, being away from social contact can be painful. And then you mentioned, you know, social isolation during the pandemic. I think that, you know, birds like humans are, and humans like birds are producing these endogenous opioids and these endogenous cannabinoids. And I think that when we're separated from our flock mates, it was so difficult, right? It was very painful. And I think that part of that is because we're deprived of our endogenous, the release of these endogenous, these naturally rewarding neurochemicals. And so, you know, it's difficult. I think a lot of people would sort of self-medicate, right? Taking other things that can release opioids. And so I think that that is something that makes it really difficult. Social isolation does lead to drug use. There are probably healthier ways to do that. And that could include exercise, like you mentioned. I think a lot of people dealt with the pain of the isolation by exercising more. I found myself heading to the pantry a lot. I think I developed a place preference for for my pantry, which had all kinds of sweet and salty, really tasty treats. And since I was working from home, I found myself just standing in the kitchen. I'm like, what am I doing here? And I thought it kind of reminded me of the birds. I had developed a preference for a place. And feeding does release opioids. Opioids, I mean, I think, you know, a lot of times people think of it, you know, someone who's taken a high dose of heroin or fentanyl, they're not eating. They're kind of feeling good. They're not eating. But low-dose opioids actually facilitates feeding behavior, and feeding seems to release opioids, especially rich fatty foods. So it's studies in rats in the psychology literature. It seems like tasty treats in rats, sometimes they use chocolate treats, seem to release opioids. I think that, you know, you can maybe try to find substitutes. It's not the same thing, but substitutes, providing people with social contact, I think, can help also. If someone's trying to stop using drugs, the social contact can release your endogenous opioids. And I think one of the hard parts is that the non-natural opioids like fentanyl, the opioids that are synthesized, they're very powerful. They really bind to those receptors very tightly. And so it's tough to compete with social reward versus drug reward, but I think it can buffer. I think the social contact can really help.
Your lab also has done some studies that seem to shed light on mental illness and what could be done. We'll talk about that in a moment when we continue with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Lauren Readers. We are talking about why do birds flock, sing, and play. You talked about, you know, choosing the starling in particular because it does a lot of vocalization, has flocking behavior. Darwin, I think, chose finches for a lot of the stuff he was writing about. Are there other kinds of birds right now being studied in similar ways where you're finding either supporting data or conflicting data?
Yeah, we have spent some time studying zebra finches, and I think they are a very popular study bird right now. And they are a little bit different from the starlings because they aren't seasonal breeders in the same way that starlings are. Actually, they breed depending on water availability. They live in arid conditions, and so when water appears, then they start breeding. But the finches, they'll live in flocks, and sometimes only males sing, actually, in the species. Females do not sing, but they still use male song to choose mates. But when...
So they don't sing at all?
They do not sing at all. Yeah, and people are interested, like, do they have, like, if you were to do a brain imaging study, do they have the same circuits that the males have? And it's a little bit different. So they still have some of the regions that control song, but it seems like those regions are important for perceiving male song instead, which I think is really interesting. But in this species, the birds live in flocks. And males, when they're courting females, they'll look at the female and they'll do a little dance and they'll raise kind of the feathers on the top of their head and dance towards the female. And then at other times, they'll sing and they'll just sing off into space. And so it's a little bit like spring and fall song, except for it's all occurring at the same time. And so we've looked at the finches, and when the males are directing the song to a particular individual, and it could be to a male or it could be to a female, we find that they do not develop a preference for a place where they sang that kind of song. But if they're just singing off into space and they're not directing the song towards any individual, at that time, that kind of song does relate to a place preference. So it seems that the kind of song that they're doing for no reason is the type of song that is rewarding, or at least associated with reward. And I think, you know, we mentioned play behavior. We actually go so far as to suggest that perhaps the starlings are playing when they're singing this fall song, and that other birds, when they're singing in these large flocks for no apparent reason, that maybe it's a playful behavior. I do want to say there are about 10,000 estimated bird species. Over 4,000 are considered songbirds, so the birds that learn song from adult tutors to learn their species-typical song. And if you look at the literature on birds, it looks like it's considered that maybe 1% of the 10,000 bird species actually play. And you can think of famous examples of birds playing. If you go on YouTube, you can see it's crows in Russia are sledding on bottle caps. It's really fascinating. You can see examples of swans surfing on waves. Ducks will walk up to a waterfall, go down, walk back up, travel down the waterfall, like going down a water slide, basically. And, you know, you say, why are they doing that? For no reason. Why are they doing that? And of course, parrots are playful. Magpies are playful. They even play with dogs. You can see pictures of this online. And there's some examples actually of birds of prey flying into the air, dropping bone fragments, catching them, flying back up, dropping bone fragments and catching them. But it's been estimated only 1% of birds play. But we think that maybe birds, when they're practicing their song, when they're young, and also in these flocks outside the breeding season, perhaps they're playing. And it was difficult, you know, it's difficult to know if an animal is playing. We do think we have evidence that they are singing for fun, which I think is, you know, this place preference we talked about. But the other things that might make this behavior play, there are certain criteria that are said to make a bird make a behavior play, because play can look a little bit like fighting. It could look a little bit like mating. So how do you know the difference? Mm-hmm. And so there's a list of published criteria. And one is that it's sloppy. And we already talked about how this song in fall and winter is a little bit sloppier than spring song, suggesting it might be play. You see that it is produced spontaneously. And we see that the birds, they just sit there and then one will just erupt into song. That for a behavior to be a playful behavior, I talked about the structural stereotype. It's not a structurally stereotyped. It's also produced in a low-stress environment. Animals stop playing if a stressor appears, and the same with our bird. If a predator appears, and sometimes in the outdoor aviaries, a hawk will appear above the aviaries. Mm-hmm. They can't get to the birds, but they'll sit right on top of them, yet the birds are silent. And so we think that, you know, all these criteria suggest that the birds are actually playing. And so I would say that it's not 1% of the bird species that are playing, but perhaps, you know, these 4,000 songbird species are also playing when they're practicing their song.
You also ask in some of the papers whether there's emotional expression going on, you know, whether birds can feel a range of emotions. This is a little off to a tangent, but a pet cockatiel I had had definite preferences. My husband was at the top of the list. I was second, and the different, you know, our three children were ranked. And you could tell it because when she would hear them come in or even hear the car door or something and knew which of the five family members, you know, it was going to be. There was a definite preference, you know, definite what seemed like happier if it was one family member than another, and different sounds, different body language. I'm sure it's really hard to study whether a bird is happy or stressed or sad or disappointed or whatever it is. But presumably birds, like humans, have a wide range of emotions.
Mm-hmm. I think that vocal behavior is like a great window into emotional states. And so birds have been studied for vocalizations that aren't learned. So songs are considered different from calls. And so all birds call, and calls are vocalizations that are much more simple in general. I mean, there's some exceptions. They can be complicated. But in general, calls are simple. They're not thought to be learned from adult tutors. They're not used to allow, you know, advertise quality, like the courtship song of a male, for example. But they are used to express alarm. So if a predator is observed, you know, a bird may make a very quick, short noise. Chickadees are different, though, because they say chickadee, dee, 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 and the number of D's they add to the end of that call is actually alerting, you know, how threatening a predator appears to them.
Which I didn't know that. So it's almost like Morse code or something, the number of D's.
It's so interesting. Hmm. But interesting, I think, so this is why there are exceptions. The chickadee song is not very elaborate. It's just that bee-boo, that little two-note. That's actually the song, and the call is more complex. But typically the song is the elaborate, complicated thing that's elaborating or advertising male quality, and calls are shorter. And so it's long been, like, people have studied chickens, and if you startle them, or baby chicks, they want to be by the parent. And if you take a chick away from its mother, it vocalizes. It's kind of a distress call or something like that. And so it's long been known that birds are expressing maybe negative emotional states. But we became really interested in positive emotional states. And I think they are reflected in the song. So we think that the singing in the flocks, that reflects a positive affective state. They will not produce that song unless they're relaxed, unless they're comfortable, and unless they're in a flock. Sometimes they'll sing alone, but not much. So something about the safety of flock. But outside that context, in the breeding season, for example, when males are singing to attract a female, we think that is reflecting a different emotional state. We don't think singing is rewarding and feeling good. We think it's that they're sexually motivated and they are expressing kind of wanting, an emotional state of desire or wanting. Mm-hmm. And so we think that these vocalizations are really a window into the emotional state experienced by the birds. And I did recently read a paper about zebra finches, and someone proposed this is a great idea. You know, if your zebra finches are popular pet animals. And so they said, this is a good idea. If your bird is singing, then you know that it's experiencing a positive affective state. And if it's not singing, then you should worry that, you know, maybe you got to enrich the environment or something like that. Zebra finches are social species, so they wouldn't really like to be alone. So I think that's really interesting that, you know, even pet shops are suggesting that you can use the vocalizations to provide insight into the emotional state.
What about the emotion of mourning or grieving? Because I know with elephants and with others, there's evidence that if a mate dies or an offspring would die, that there's emotion there and that it's conveyed somehow, sort of the way we might sing the blues, or go into a minor key. Is there a sort of song or call that would suggest mourning?
Now, that's an interesting idea, and I haven't seen anything about that specifically, but there are examples, and again, this goes a little bit beyond my expertise, but in just reading about bird behavior, because I think they're fascinating, there are examples of these crow funerals, where mm-hmm. if the crows find a dead crow in a certain area, they all gather and they caw. They vocalize at really high rates. And they find that where that happens, birds will avoid that area for a month. Mm-hmm. And I think it even has to do with the, I think that people think, are they experiencing sadness or is it just something that's evolved because if there was a predator and it killed mm-hmm. that crow, it may be a very good idea to mm-hmm. stay away from there for a month or however long they're staying away.
But if a baby bird falls out of a nest and perishes,
right, what happens
does
there?
The adult song change?
I've not seen any evidence of that, but what I know this is just from watching in my backyard. We had blue jays in the backyard. Mm-hmm. They had a nest, and then the babies land on the ground. So before they can fly, they will leave the nest, and they'll be on the ground. And they're very vulnerable to predators there. And what we really saw is that the parents were near the offspring. So you would see the parent blue jays kind of down in the bushes, and you would not see the baby. And so I wouldn't say, it's not that the baby had died, but I think this the baby's in a vulnerable situation, and the adults were certainly in a state of agitation. It didn't seem to be reflected in the vocal behaviors, and I wonder if that's because you're trying to avoid attracting predators. So it may be one of those situations. Yeah, that's an interesting idea, though.
I know we have by now really combated the notion of being bird-brained. We can definitely tell that birds are sophisticated, their brains are complex. Besides their ability to find their way home without a GPS, what do you see when you study birds? And you spend hours and hours studying birds. What do you marvel about birds as unique and, sort of better than humans? Or were you looking at it and you just can't believe it?
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, we've already talked about the fact that they can learn these elaborate songs.
But we can too, right?
That's true. Humans can do that as well.
We can play instruments and we can...
That's right. What can they do that we can't? Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the things that I found really fascinating is there are... some species of bird that can cache seeds, they hide seeds, and they will hide seeds in, hundreds of locations. And some of these birds can do in more than hundreds of locations. And then they can go back and find these seeds months later. But one of the things I think is...
We can't even find our keys. So,
that's right. Yes. We can't even find our keys. But another thing that people are starting to find is that there is this kind of deception going on because other birds will be observing the birds that are hiding the seeds. And the bird that's hiding the seed, it appears that they're aware of this and they will take that seed and move it. Or they might make a noise that sounds as if they're burying the seed and not actually bury the seed. Or they'll bury the seed behind something where another bird can't see it. And so I think that, maybe this is something humans, obviously, we engage in deception.
Well, we have Swiss bank accounts and move money around.
I think it highlights, though, that these birds are crafty and they're really clever. And another thing I think that's really interesting, it's not something that humans can't do, but it's just something that made me think, wow, birds are really remarkable, is they're these bower birds in Australia. And the males are some of them are pretty plain looking, but they build these elaborate architectural structures called bowers. These are things also you can go online, but they'll build these elaborate structures out of twigs, out of leaves, and they'll decorate them. They'll decorate them with, it could be shells It could be flower petals. They can find things, you know, from human picnics, like maybe they're into blue bottle caps and they'll just like place the blue bottle cap in and they just elaborately create this bower and try to entice, they use it to try to entice a female to mate. And so if you look at these structures, you would not think that, you'd think a human made the structures. And so again, it's not that it's something that a human can't do, but I think it highlights that birds are much more clever and they have a much more complex brain and more abilities that people would not think that they were capable of. And people have even proposed that maybe these bowers represent a form of art because they do.
I was just going to say, it sounds like they're artists, they're architects. And they sing too. Your lab also studies implications for mental health, you know, how you can look at birds where something is not happening that you would expect it to be happening with flocking or singing or playing, and what that might tell us about mental illness.
Yeah, so one thing that we were really interested in is when you look at mental health disorders, they often are associated with communication deficits. So if you think of social anxiety or if you think of depression, many people become socially withdrawn and they don't want to engage in, you know, positive, you know, what would have been positive interactions. Those interactions, hanging out with friends, chit-chatting, is just not rewarding, and humans can become socially withdrawn. But other types of communication are not always as devastated. So, for example, if a person with depression or anxiety is hungry, often they could ask for food. You know, you get an apple, it's rewarding. And so we think that different types of communication are differentially impacted by mental health disorders. And so we're really interested in what is it that naturally rewards communication in different contexts. And we think that in the songbirds, we have a really interesting system where we do have something that almost models where humans come together and chit-chat. You know, over the holidays, people like to get together and they just like to talk about any old thing. And so I think that that's the type of communication and social interaction that is most devastated by mental illness. And so I think that by studying birds, we have a really unique window into trying to understand some of the mechanisms like endocannabinoids or opioids that make those types of interactions positive and rewarding that may be dysregulated in humans when they are experiencing a mental illness.
So could that give some insight into designing medications then? Or,
yeah, that's right. I think that this is going to be an excellent way. I mean, people could study, like right now, they study rats as models for drug addiction to figure out how to treat drug addiction. And so in the same sense, I think birds may be a better system to try to understand what can be used to promote positive social interactions.
If you can imagine coming for an interview 5-10 years from now,
right?
What do you think what are you hoping you might be able to report on at that point in terms of where your research with songbirds might go in different directions, shed new light on other areas?
You know, I think one thing that I've become really interested just by studying the songbirds is just motivation and reward. What motivates behavior, what rewards behavior. And so I think that, you know, we would like to expand and look at motivation and reward in other contexts, maybe even in humans. And this is like something I'm just really interested in, what can lead to life satisfaction in humans? And is it exercise? Is it the pursuit of, you know, different activities that people are really interested in? And I love the idea of, and this wouldn't be my area of expertise right now, but maybe in 10 years, I would love it if a human is having a mental illness or a concern, if we could prescribe them something that wasn't a drug, not a medication, but you could say, okay, you're going to get on your exercise bike for this many minutes and you're going to jog around the block for this many minutes, or you're going to get into a hot tub and experience some hot water. I think that it would be fascinating to sort of find non-pharmaceutical ways to promote positive social interactions. And I'm thinking the birds could be the start of that, and it'd be really interesting to see where we might take that in the future.
Sounds like joining a choir might be a good one, too.
Yeah, I think so. And I think there's evidence for that. Like you said, it's not just anecdotal. People have studied it, and they do find that humans joining a choir and singing is a real positive thing.
Going to a comedy club and laughing.
Yes, I think laughter, too. It's the best medicine, as they say.
My guest has been Lauren Readers. We've been talking about why do birds flock, sing, and play. Thank you for joining me. I'll never hear birds the same way again, I think.
That's great. Thanks a lot.
I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.